All right, folks, I have a gentleman here, Johnny Scanlon. Is that pronounced correctly, is it?
Yeah, Johnny Scanlon.
Scanlon. And I have him on the podcast today, just as it is Mental Health Awareness Week. Johnny was happy to talk about his story because he was linked with an organization called HURT in the city. And obviously then to kind of be more aware and create awareness around drugs and alcohol that is rampant in the city. I wanted Johnny to kind of give his story and what some people might be feeling and where they can kind of go for help and so on. So I want to welcome you, Johnny, and I really appreciate you taking the time to tell and open up about you and what you went through. It's not an easy thing to do, but again, hopefully it's going to help somebody out there. So the main thing we're going to talk about today is like the HURT and the organization. And so, and before we get into that, what was it that you were, I was going to say suffer from, but not really suffer from, what took to the point where you reached out for help and reached out to like HURT for help? What were you going through that took it to that point?
Well, thanks for having me on, Seamus. The point that took me to HURT was I was about 18 years old. I was living in the Stranfire. It's a homeless place for young adults. They were quite concerned about the amount I was drinking. And they sort of gave me an ultimatum of, you know, if you're going to stay here, you need to talk to somebody about your alcohol addiction. And it was at that point, I was just thinking, I don't have an addiction here, you know, 18, I'm drinking, you know, just being a normal sort of young person. But they sent me up to HURT Every Tomorrow's, which was literally around the street. And I went up there for the first time in 2008, so it was. And I had been, you know, went in and it was sort of like, it was scary going in because, you know, it's the first time I sort of reached out for help for an addiction that I didn't recognize. I was like, I don't have the problem. But I wanted to stay where I was staying. So I was like, you know what, let's just go with this and see what happens. So that was like the, it was an ultimatum at that point. But in 2017 was the first time I actually reached out for help because addiction had actually got to me too much. I'd lost so much of my life because of addiction. It was the first time I sort of went to HURT and says, listen, I really need help. This addiction has destroyed everything that I've built or had. And it was actually a breakup with of a relationship that, you know, pushed me to back into HURT to sort of like a last call. I needed help.
Like obviously this is the first time I'm hearing your story too, so and we're going off the cuff and I'll be probably taking you back and forward through different things because things will be interesting to me and I want to kind of learn more. But way before with that first time, you had mentioned there you were in that homeless shelter and stuff. So what happened before that? What were you doing? You know, did you leave school early? Were you, what sort of life were you having before that? That it got to the point that you were actually in that shelter?
Well, when I was younger, like my mum had an alcohol problem as well.
Right.
So I grew up in Nazareth House Children's Home.
Okay.
So I spent 7 years in Nazareth House in the social services. And then my mum passed away when I was 10. She passed away in 1989. That pushed me then to move in with my father, and it wasn't a great sort of place to grow up, and I really struggled. So I was living with my father for about 4 or 5 years, and at 16 I sort of moved in with my cousin. And then she had she fell pregnant, and I moved in back to Derry. And then I moved into the Stranfair when I was 17.
Right. And Nazareth House, so whenever you're kind of moving to your dad's, and then are you moving all across Northern Ireland? Is this all in the city here? Or
my mum initially, when we first went into Nazareth House, was in Strabane, and then she moved to Derry. But my father was in Strabane, so mostly in Derry, but then in my teenage years I moved to Strabane, mm-hmm. which was a bit of a different, you know, sort of event. And there I had a family life, as like a normal family upbringing. So going from a children's home into a family was a big, I really struggled with.
I was going to ask, what was it like in Nazareth House and stuff? What was the life for you? Did you, like, you're talking about, like, moving then to your dad's place and having more of a normal, did it not seem normal to you then? What was different about it that...
I know people have different stories from children's home, but I genuinely loved it. Mm. You know, the staff were really nice. I was with my two sisters. So for me, I was seeing my mum a lot. For me, that was my normal sort of life, you know.
Yeah.
Going to school, and then suddenly, you know, being surrounded by other people, and I didn't really know anything different. So when I actually went into live with my father, I was like, I don't like this, you know. This normal family life I just couldn't get used to.
Didn't feel right.
Yeah. For me, it was just, no, I couldn't cope with it. So the fact that me and my father and my stepmother, we never really got on.
Right.
So when I was about 16, my cousin sort of says, here, you can move on with us for a while.
Yeah.
So
when did it start getting to the point where you sort of took to the drink and stuff? So was it whenever you made that change, or... whenever you moved, or when was it that sort of all started, and what was the main reason? Did you just think it was, you're just being a teenage fella, you're just enjoying the drink, or what was going through your mind at that stage whenever you started?
For me, I was like 11 when I was living sort of in the family environment, sort of 11, around 11. Being in and out of the house and stuff, you know, there was drink there, and I was naive, to be honest. Like, I was thinking, vodka was the thing my mum drank, so I thought, why not try this thing that, you know, took my mum?
Yes.
So that's why, you know, little drinks of vodka here and there, or steal a beer can or whatever, but...
At 11?
11, you know, and then as I got older... It was mainly about 16, 17 that I was fully immersed in the drinking anything and everything. Mm-hmm. When I moved into the Strand Foyer and had my own freedom, the drinking just became, you know, everything.
And would you say it was kind of like the environment too? And were you there with other people, or was this just like, this was just a decision that you had made, or...
Like, when I started at 17, when I was in the foyer, it was mainly because, you know, I could get away with it. There was nobody telling me I couldn't drink.
Right.
So, and then, you know, you're surrounded by other people, and they're all different ages, you know. But mainly I drank a lot on my own because, like, to be honest, it was more out of greed than anything. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't want to share drink. I did drink with other people, and...
Yeah,
you know, but it wasn't something that I would do often. It was more, you know, I'd rather drink on my own because, you know, I'm not sharing the drink. But
yeah,
I didn't realize it was like one of the things that a lot of drinkers would do is drink by themselves.
Yeah,
you know, we're our own worst company, to be honest. Like,
yeah, And like I was like today I had another conversation with Gary Rutherford over in Arc Fitness, and like he's doing his program as well. But like we kind of mentioned, we talked about it, like the drugs and alcohol is like a cover up nearly to what you're kind of hiding or to the problem. It could be work, it could be stress, it could be a number of things. Do you know what yours was, what you were kind of covering up or what? Or
for me, it was the fact that I lost my mum.
Right.
And then I didn't really cope with it well. You know, going through my teenage years, I was self-harming, I was suicidal and drinking. It wasn't sort of a normal, you know, I'll have a few beers. It was, I'll drink until I wake up the next morning and have no memory.
Right.
Of the night before, of anything I've done, anywhere I was, stuff like that. I was like a blackout drinker, and I would drink until I just passed out. You know?
Yeah. And that's whenever you were in the what do you call that place, the foyer?
Yeah, the Strand Foyer.
Yeah.
I was very lucky. I was in the Strand Foyer because they were very supportive of me. You know, they helped me manage the times with like my self-harming and my suicidal thoughts. They were always there, you know, it was one of those things that I probably, you know, put down as a staff at a lot of bother because like constantly drinking and falling out on the phone with my father or somebody or whatever, you know, or, you know, coming down with cuts in my arms and stuff. So
yeah,
it wasn't a good place mentally, but I was in the right place for it.
Yes.
That makes sense.
You had support there. People who had your well-being in check, and they were obviously caring for you and they were concerned about your well-being.
Aye.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that was good. And how long were you there for, did you say?
I was there for just over 6 years, from 17 to 23.
It was 2017, did you say, that you said that was really whenever you went back again, this was like the second time and you reached out again?
But 2017 was when I was like at my wit's end.
Yes. What happened between the first time and then? Like what was it? What was going on? You just progressively got worse then?
It was getting worse and worse. And beforehand, I was going to hurt maybe twice, a couple of times before and between the times.
Yeah.
Mainly to try and calm the drinking down, you know, drink responsibly.
Yes.
Because I thought I could. And for a month or so, I would be able to drink responsibly and then I'd go back off the rails again.
Yeah.
And like, I was going, had amazing opportunities with like foreign language school. I moved to Spain for 3 months. And basically, every weekend, I was just rat-arsed, you know. And I was just, I really, you know, threw great opportunities out the window constantly. Right. All because I was drinking. And along the way, I lost family, I lost friends, I lost, you know, opportunities, jobs, the works, you know. And then in 2017, I was in a relationship, and when that ended, it was literally the only thing left in my life was either drinking or, you know, keep living. So
yeah.
It was that sort of, it got to that point where I just literally had the bottle of vodka in one hand and a telephone in the other, and it was like, which one do I choose?
Wow. That's one way of putting it. That's quite the picture there. You know, and you have, like, everybody has choice, you know, as well. And it's great that you made that decision to go, I'm going to ring somebody. Do you know what I mean? And so this time, whenever you went back to your heart, how did it start then? What was different this time? And what was the process of getting sober?
Like, it was basically, I went in 2016. I was living in Italy on a program called European Voluntary Service. I met someone. We kept seeing each other, but she was the first one to sort of say, you drink a lot, you know, and it was a bit of a concern. And it was the first time in my life that, you know, an addiction, it's like you're surrounded by mirrors. The only person you can see you're hurting is yourself. And right. It was the first time that the mirrors came down and I could see that I was hurting other people.
Mm-hmm.
And that made drinking worse because I could see I was hurting people and I wanted to block the feelings out. But at the same time, I was trying to stop. And it was like a really difficult period. It was November that I went on the hurt and I said, I was talking to Sadie who founded the place. And I says, I really need something. I need help before I lose everything.
Yeah.
And they says, well, you know, we'll get you back on the program and we'll get you seeing a counselor. And that was the start of the journey. And then it would be about March, the next March 2017 that I went on the Kenmura, the rehab in Newry.
Right. What about the process then that they put you through initially? The program, whenever you say you, not the rehab, but the program leading into that, what does that entail?
Well, with hurt, it was the acupuncture, which is the little needles in your ear.
Mm.
And I'm covered in tattoos, but I struggle with needles. but, you know, it's 45 minutes where you just sit there and you have some time on your own and you're not worrying about where I'm going to go and getting a drink. I'm doing this and doing that. You're just trying to relax.
Yeah.
And then you get that for a few weeks and then you get a counselor. And this was the first time I had a new counselor, one that I hadn't had before. And it was 30 minutes into the session and he just was listening. And then he just interrupted me and he was like, listen, this is the way I see it. And I was just like, oh, that sounds like it's problematic, you know? And I was like, I know alcohol is a problem, but I didn't realize how big of a problem it actually was until somebody sort of laid it out in front of me. And the terms he used was, you're married to alcohol.
Aye.
And they're cheating on it. And I was just like leaving the counseling session, like going, hang on a minute, what? No, really? No. And then the following sessions, he was saying, look, most likely you'll need rehab to get out of your addiction to alcohol. And
mm-hmm.
And in my head, when you hear rehab, you think of all the celebrity rehabs and they're really expensive and mm-hmm. all this. And it was like a week after St. Patrick's Day, and me and the girlfriend broke up on the Monday. The Tuesday I was in talking to Sadie again and says, there, I need something. And I really need the counseling's working, but it's not working to the point where I need it to be working.
Yeah.
So it was then that they gave me a number for Kenmura and Newry.
Mm-hmm.
So that was on the Tuesday. And then by the Friday, I was on a bus on the way to Newry. So
wow.
It was pretty quick. And I did zero research into the whole,
mm-hmm.
what Kenmura was. And when I arrived, there was pictures of Jesus and all these like pictures of Mary, and I was like, I'm in the wrong place. I ended up here, and the guy that met me at the door, he was like a former priest, and he explained the whole thing. I was like, oh crap, what am I doing here? You know, I'm a wee Protestant from Derry. I shouldn't be in a rehab. And honestly, I couldn't have been in a more better place than Kenmura. It mm-hmm. really was, like, everybody says, oh, how did you cope with like going to mass 4 times a week and rosary every night? And it got me sober, like, you know.
Yeah.
And that's the main thing. And for me, it was like the weirdest 3 months of my life.
I'm sure it took a time to adjust to that big time. Like, you didn't go first week, right? I'm just going to go to mass 4 times a week. It took you a while to adjust, yeah?
Well, you don't get the choice of going to mass. You've got mass or in a wee room for silent meditation. So, you know, you don't want to be isolating yourself from the rest of the the people. So you're sort of like, okay, mass, here we go.
How was that first? Do you remember the first time you went? What was it like?
For me, it was just like, what have I got myself on for? You know, 2 weeks of detox unit. So you have 2 weeks coming off your alcohol. You've no TV, you've no radio, you've no telephone, no newspapers, nothing. It's just you and 30 other men sort of sitting around, sort of going, how do we end up here? Like, and some people had been coming back every 6 months, or some, like for me, I was the youngest for about a week, and then you have people coming and going, and the only thing you could do was be alone with your thoughts and read. And for me, they were two of the scariest things, because unless it's to do with history, I don't read.
But I had to
read books, and then being alone with your thoughts, and you can't go walking, you can't do anything. You're in this bubble.
That's quite intense. That's quite intense, being alone there with your own thoughts and stuff. And like you said, it was crazy. But was there any other sort of what is that like for you? From, you know, did you feel almost forced into kind of getting into this routine? Where did you feel open to it? You know, what was it like?
It was one of those sort of moments, because before I went into rehab, I had to go talk to the doctors and stuff, and the doctor pretty much told me, with me drinking vodka and Guinness, he says, you're not going to live long.
Yeah.
You know, you'll be lucky. I was 28 at the time. He says, you're lucky for 6 years at most, if you continue drinking like this.
Yeah.
And he says, but with alcohol, you'll probably get a higher tolerance, and that could go down. So it was either die by 34, 35, or give us a shot. So
You had hope. You had hope still. Gary talks a lot about hope, and you have a glimpse of that, and there was enough for you to go and go to rehab. What sort of books and stuff were you reading then?
Honestly, anything that I could find. Like, I was reading Anton Deck's autobiography. I was
right, okay.
Billy Connolly, I was reading. There was nothing deep and, mythology or anything. It was
right,
like,
okay.
I just need something to not be thinking inside my head. So
yes.
That's what I was just reading, anything and everything. And people were like, oh, try this book. So I was reading, books from my 80s, 70s, 80s, anything they sort of
take your mind off things. And what else was there then? What other things could you have done there? Or what was it?
The main things that you had to do was you had to do the group sessions in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
Every morning you had meditation. Every evening you had the rosary. These were sort of the fundamentals of the program.
Mm-hmm.
And other than that, you were in the detox unit for 2 weeks. So you weren't out walking. You didn't have exercise yards. You didn't have anything like that.
Yeah.
But then after the 2 weeks, you get moved into the bigger unit. There's more people there, and you have more freedom.
Right.
You know, you had responsibilities. You could be in the kitchen, gardening, woodwork. So when you moved up to the other unit, then it was sort of like more structured. Every week you had a topic you were learning with in the group.
Uh-huh.
And it was crazy, because you were talking to people and you were like, "What? Well, I'm not an alcoholic, because this guy's drinking whiskey 4 times a day, and I'm only drinking at the weekends." And by the end of the 12th week, you're there 3 months, and if you make it through it, well done. Because by the 12th week, you're like, "Well, you know what? Alcohol, being an addict, there's no quantity you have to meet to be an addict."
Mm-hmm.
It's impacting your life, and you're always craving it. You know, it doesn't matter if it's one beer a day or 30 beers a day, or
That's an interesting point. That's very interesting. Is this just something that you, or is this that you've sort of been aware of, or is from talking to people, or is that something the counselor had said to you? Or
no, when you're talking to people, like, you're in there with people that are drinking 2 bottles of vodka a day, and then there's another guy down in the corner and he's drinking four pints at the bar and a half bottle at night, every night. And then there's like people like me who was drinking from Friday to Monday, and then a Wednesday to get yourself through to the weekend, you know? And it's sort of one of those things that you sort of go, none of us are doing the exact same thing apart from drinking. They're all different ways of coping with it and different reasons for drinking, and it's impacting people in different ways. So for me, it was just like, no, you're meant to be here because alcohol is causing you problems. It doesn't matter how much you're drinking. It's that alcohol is, you know, just taking you away from what you're meant to be doing in life, you know, meant to be the real person. Instead, you're just, you know, anytime you feel bad, good, happy, sad, depressed, lonely, you drink. And that's like, you know,
that's just the one only thing you're sort of thinking on. It doesn't matter what the emotion really is.
And then you just sort of coming down and life, you're just like, you know, oh, sure, it's what I'm meant to do. It's what all, like when you travel, people are like, oh, you're Irish, come on, let's drink. And get in your sort of psyche was just, oh, I'm Irish, I'm meant to be drinking. And then I just got to the point where I didn't care if it was Irish or whatever. It was, I have things to bury here, and you know, the best way to do it is drinking. The unfortunate thing that you learn after rehab is, you know, your problems can swim, you can't drown them.
Right, very good, very good. You have to deal with them, you know. You have to face it head on. You know, there, you've always got choice, and there's always another option. Would that be?
It's definitely the way it is.
And for someone listening, like who maybe hasn't said to anyone, or maybe there's a family member who's concerned, and maybe they're listening here now. Two sort of scenarios there. So with the first one, if somebody hasn't said anything to anyone but realizes there's a bit of a problem and it's really affecting them, what would you say to them to do? What would you, like, they're really resonating with you here and, you know, feeling what you're going through. What would you say to them? How would you say to them to first cope? Is there anything before approaching someone, or you know, how to make their mindset and their thought process a little bit more positive so that they can take the next step?
The thing is, like, it's the hardest thing you have to do, and that's ask for help. And the way I had to do it was, I had to be at rock bottom for me to make the step into I need help. But looking back, there was plenty of opportunities where I could have went, you know what, I'm really struggling here. And coming through rehab, the one thing that I never sort of said to myself was, I'm an alcoholic, you know? And it was the first time in rehab that I said it to myself. And I realized that would have probably put me into, you know, a place where I needed, I would have wanted the help myself, but I never put myself in that scenario. So the advice I would give somebody is, ask the closest person you know, the closest person to you, do you think I drink too much? Because they're not going to lie to you. They're going to give you an honest answer. And if they say, yeah, I think you drink too much, or is it a problem for you? Then, you know, the only person that can tell you that you have a problem is yourself. But if somebody, if you hear somebody else reiterating what you fear, it makes you go, yeah, maybe there's something.
I awaken to it, you know, in a way. And that's a good thing. Sometimes it's hard for people. If you were to kind of say to me, do you think if I drink too much? Like for me, maybe being on the other side, and I'm not talking about me personally, but that person who they're asking would find it maybe difficult to be honest and show their concern, you know, in some ways. Like, would you agree in some instances?
Well, for me, I would always ask the person that I know that, you know, that probably would be affected by my behavior.
Right, okay.
So, like a best friend or a mother or brother or somebody that you know, because in your head you know there is a problem here, but once you put it into words and you ask someone, and they tell you, we do think you drink a bit much.
Aye.
That there then goes, okay, there is a problem. I'm not making this up.
You know? Okay, yeah.
And you feel that the person most likely, most people turn around and say, but, you know, we can help you. You know, we'll support you. Because that's, like, for me, having lost everything, like, I had the choice of either going to rehab or just continue drinking until I killed myself. And I didn't ask. I didn't have anybody to ask other than myself because I'd lost everything. And I was just sitting on a sofa in the Simon community on the Waterside in a pair of boxer shorts, absolutely shivering with, you know, cold, detoxing from alcohol, sweating. And I was just like, how do I keep ending up here? You know, it's happened time and time again. And, you know, it sort of clicked in my head. It's because you're always drinking. It's always coming back to why we are coping with what we're coping.
Yeah.
That was, and that coping mechanism was alcohol.
You said a couple of good things there as well. The person who has to sort of agree with the addict, basically just to be honest, and I guess as well, do it in a non-judgmental way, or, you know, be, you know, and be supportive, as you, that was the word that you said as well. Just let them know that you will be there, because sometimes anger can flare up and all, and it doesn't help the situation. But again, I think the way you put it, being honest, being supportive about it, I think you can't go too far wrong in that sense.
Yeah, the thing too about it is, the last person to know that they're an alcoholic or an addict is the person themselves.
Yeah.
You know, everybody around me was, I was like, you know, telling people I'm going into rehab, and they're like, yeah, about time, you know, you're struggling with alohol. We're telling you this. But when you're an addiction, you don't hear people like saying, oh, you know, you do drink a lot. You're like, no, I only drink at the weekends, or I only drink, you know, here and then. But when you become aware of it, and people, and you sort of think that you made this breakthrough, and you're like, oh, break the news to everyone, I'm an alcoholic. And they're like, we know. It's sort of like, you know, it's probably the hardest thing, because you're sort of wondering why they didn't tell you, but they have been telling you. You haven't been listening.
Right.
But it's frustrating for other people to see a loved one go through alcohol, you know, an addiction, because they want to help, but the truth is, you can't help someone that doesn't want help.
Yes. And whenever they do want help, see the like of you, and you're talking about support, what ways can they support? Like, is it taking them to appointments? Is it just taking them a walk? What sort of things do you mean by that support? You know, is it, you know, what sort of things did you find helpful?
For me, like, once, because I literally, my turnaround was like Monday alcoholic, Friday rehab. So for the 3 months, I had no real contact with the outside world apart from letters. And it was that was the thing that was difficult for me, was I had the ex-girlfriend sending me letters about my behavior. I had people that I had, you know, was writing to and hearing, you know, how they cared about me, but how I affected them. And for me, the only way you can support someone is just by being there for them. If they don't want to talk, you don't have to make them talk. You don't have to listen. Just be there for them. Say to them, listen, I'm at the other end of the telephone. Not being judgmental, you know. And it's difficult because you want to help that person because you love them. And if they're not picking that help, it's hard for you not to get angry. You're like, why can't you, you know, get better?
Yes.
But you have to be supportive and just hope that they can see the light themselves.
For themselves, yeah.
Yeah. It's difficult.
That is a tough one. It is very much so. Now that you've went through the rehab, how long have you been clean, so to speak? How long have you?
I went into rehab March 27th, so I've been in recovery for coming up to, I think that's 4 years.
Coming up no. 4 years, yeah. Well, 2017 will no. be. Yeah, well, that's
coming up, yeah. And then sobriety. The funny thing about my sobriety is, I count my sobriety from when I last had a drink, which would have been in March 2018, St. Patrick's Day. Mm-hmm. So, a lot of people count, you know, the recovery and the sobriety, but and then some people are like, don't believe in counting sobriety. You know, the longest you can be sober is 24 hours. But I
right, I get you. Yes.
Yeah. That slightly annoys me because, you know, I've worked hard to get sober.
Yes.
You know, yes. I like my cousin and stuff, family, friends and stuff are all like, oh, how long are you sober? And you're like, yeah, coming up to 3-4 years. And they're like, oh, that's amazing. But if you're like, I'm only sober for 24 hours, I understand why people do it. But for me, it's sort of like, I prefer to say, no, I'm sober 3 years.
It's awesome.
For me, it's the sense of accomplishment that I've overcome. I haven't overcome, I fight it every day, but I'm still fighting 3 years
100%. That's awesome, man.
But for some people, if they want to say, like, the thing about sobriety is it's individual.
Yes.
Some people will go to AA, Alcoholic Anonymous, or Narcotics Anonymous. Other people like myself do it, you know, a different way.
Yeah.
But it's how you find your own sobriety journey and how you celebrate it. Whether it's every morning, you know, one day at a time, sort of. Mm-hmm.
I want to ask you as well, now that you have come through the other end and you chose life, like, earlier on whenever you went to rehab, like, you had that glimmer of hope, you chose life. What have you done now since you've been sober that you thought you would have never done, that choosing getting sober, that you would have never had that experience? Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah. For me, the biggest thing and the best thing, I think, since I've got sober is rebuilding relationships with people I thought I'd lost forever. The likes of being able to build a relationship with my sister,
yes,
my father, my cousin, friends that, you know, when I was younger, they helped raise me. And
yes,
through addiction, we lost contact. Mm-hmm. For me, it's probably the best thing is building up a support network of people,
mm-hmm,
that, you know, no matter what you do, they're going to be there for you. They're, you know, going for a lunch with, you know, your sister for the first time in 12 years, and you just, you know, something you've never imagined that you'll do.
Mm-hmm.
You're sitting there doing. And for me, that's what I've been doing for the last 3 years.
That's just class. Been
rediscovering me, you know.
That's amazing, man. Because, you know, I myself would have thought, I would have done, just an example, could have been, I went wall climbing, or I went this, or I did this, or I did that. And it's, you know, it's none of that. It's the relationships. And that's amazing that that's the main thing that you've said. My perception of it was way off there. And
For some people, like, they're like, you know, I've done this, this, and this. And,
you know.
Everybody has different way of doing it. Like,
yeah,
you know, like my doctor always turns around, like I was talking to my doctor and he's like, you know, after addiction, sometimes you switch your addiction to something else. And, you know, I was like, oh, right. Like what? And he was like, first one's smoking, second one's like sex drive, third one's the gym. What have you been doing? I was like, I've been eating. And he's like, oh, well, that's number five. And I was like, well, I didn't get a fun one. You know, my perception, and, you know, when I got out of my alcohol addiction, was like, you know, I've done, you know, I've no more addictions, but yes. I transferred mine to food.
To food.
And yeah, but it was weird because, like, the doctor's like, you know, listing all these ones. I was like, I could have been, you know, like a gym ball, you know, like buff man, or,
yeah,
you know, something like that. But no, I was, you know, eating away at a bag of Maltesers, like eating my feelings instead. And, you know, for me, it was quite funny because, like, I went from an alcoholic to, like, a binge eater.
Yes.
It's like going, right, for the last, like, 2 years, I've been trying to lose weight to, like, live a healthy life. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's just like, yeah, let's just, you know, hopefully put an end to this addiction sort of thing. Keep fighting my addiction, but, you know, let's not get addicted to anything else.
Have you got an exercise program? Are you following any regime at the moment, or
do you want to?
At the minute, I
do a lot of running, you know. Right. It helps me, but when I got out of rehab, the first thing I did was people were like, okay, you have to replace your addiction with something healthy. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, right. What class is this healthy? Because I don't know, you know, because when I came out of addiction, I had to relearn hygiene, you know, brushing your teeth, washing clothes, showering every day, you know, different things that people would sort of like go, surely that's, you know, every human being knows how to wash themselves. So like,
yeah.
No, I got up in the morning and poured myself a beer, watched Jeremy Kyle, you know. Mm. They're like, yeah, but when did you brush your teeth? And you're like, I didn't, you know. Hygiene's not on your, you know,
priority. It's not in your essentials. Yeah. No.
So, you know, when you come out of addiction, people don't realize it, but you're basically starting afresh as a human being because you're sort of relearning who you are. You're relearning society, what's okay to do and not to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's so much stuff that you don't realize you have to relearn.
Yeah. One final question. Since now that you're clean, what's your main goal? What do you want to do now with your life? What is one thing that you want to accomplish?
For me, it's just, you know, keep fighting my addiction every day.
You've accomplished that, have you? And it's just maintaining that now, is it?
For me, it's every day. Like, there's days I get up in the morning, I don't even think about my addiction. And there's other days I'm lying in bed, like, going, Christ, I don't want to, you know, it's, the off license is, you know, 20 meters or two streets away from me. And, you know, but for me, it's staying sober because I have rebuilt a life that I don't want to lose. I've worked hard to get where I am. And my main aim now is to stay alive for the people that I love and, you know, keep my sobriety for me so I don't lose the things that I've, you know,
that you've gained. Yes. Man, that's an amazing, amazing story. A major accomplishment for yourself. You can't finish it any better than that, I don't think. I would love to kind of, hopefully we'll meet in person at some stage, but I really appreciate you sharing your story, and hopefully somebody gets something out of this and they reach out for help. Have you any final words yourself that you want to say?
Anybody listening that's struggling, you're honestly not alone. You know, it's the hardest thing you'll ever do, but it's the best thing you'll ever do is reaching out for a bit of help. And, you know, you can do it. If I can do it, anybody can do it.
Excellent. Excellent, my man. Hey, thank you so much.
Not a problem.
Nice to get chatting. Yeah, nice chatting to you, buddy. And I'll hopefully see you again.
Not a problem.